Welcome to the Story Night podcast, where you hear true stories on a theme, recorded live on stage and without notes. I'm your host, Jessica Holmes. Today, we turn the spotlight on love. Twisted, tainted, star-crossed love. Stories of faded attractions from our February 2011 show. First, featured storyteller Susanna Danner finds a burning passion in Big Sur.
So when I was a kid, I didn't have a dog. I had a fish tank full of pet leeches. I raised baby birds and praying mantises and snakes and frogs, and I was lucky to grow up in an environment full of animals and plants and wild places. And I loved it so much that I've devoted my adult life to conservation so that kids in the future can have the kind of childhood I had. So I want to tell you tonight about one of those wild places that became a setting for love and tragedy. So imagine you're walking south down the coast of California. To your right is the Pacific Ocean with an underwater kelp forest that has sea otters bobbing on top of it, using their chests as anvils to break abalone against. Beyond them are basking sharks and white sharks that swim through underwater chasms. To your left is maritime chaparral with rare blue butterflies flitting through it, and above that are redwood forests and tan oak forests that have chanterelle mushrooms emerging through the leaf litter, all the way to the very top of the mountains, which are made of granite and white marble. You splash through a stream full of steelhead, and your feet stumble over pebbles made out of jade. And as you look ahead, you see an enormous dead gray whale with California condors perched all over it. Hardly sounds like the setting for tragedy, right? I mean, this is the place that inspired Edward Weston and Jack Kerouac. This is Big Sur, primordial California, still the same as the native people might have seen it. The only thing missing are grizzly bears. So this is 70 miles of coastline that's largely free of the hucksterism that plagues most of the California coast, and there's a good reason for that. It didn't even have a highway until the 1930s, still has very few paved roads, and it's very steep. It's characterized by the kind of things that most people don't want to live around, earthquakes, wildfires, floods, rock slides, ticks, and unending poison oak. So once I was sitting on a hillside looking south at Big Sur, and I was hugging my hapless boyfriend at the time, and I was suffused with this feeling that was, it felt like guilt or shame. And at first I couldn't figure out why, and then I realized that I was cheating on Big Sur, and it could see me. And it dawned on me that I had fallen irretrievably in love with Big Sur, more than with any boyfriend before or since. This is a love that's been long-lasting for me. And I, the problem I've had with it is that it's hard to be in love with a place because you have to live there, because if you didn't, it would be kind of like a long-distance relationship. And we all know those do not work. A place can't, send you flowers on Valentine's Day. It can't file jointly with you on your taxes. It can't tell you it loves you. But on the other hand, a place will never bore you. It will never cheat on you. It will always accept you just the way you are. And no matter what you do, it will always take you back. Well, more than anything, what I wanted was to not have that long-distance relationship. I wanted to live in this place that I loved. But there's very little buildable land in Big Sur, and what little there is really expensive, and I just couldn't make it work. So I did the next best thing. I got a job in Big Sur. And the people I met when I worked in Big Sur, those friends have become the best friends I have in my life. And they've taught me lessons that have shaped me as a person. How to operate a tractor, how to skin out a steer, how to knead bread, how to sharpen a machete on a piece of flat slate. These friends have been very dear to me, and the dearest one of all is a man named Jeff Norman. And I had heard about Jeff before I ever met him. He was the coast historian and naturalist, And he was this rare combination of an Aramite and a raconteur. He could repair any tool. He could identify rare ferns. He would sometimes break into a show tune to illustrate a point. And he knew the family trees of all the Big Sur homesteaders by heart. Well, Jeff lived on 20 acres of land that had been homesteaded by Swedish pioneers. And they had named it Alta Vista. And they built a hand-hewn redwood cabin there that Jeff lived in. But Alta Vista had no road access. It was accessible only by trail, and that trail ascended 3,000 feet in 3 miles. Jeff made this steep trek every week with only the help of his mule, whose name was Whitey, and the company of his Australian shepherd, whose name was Mocho. Well, Jeff and I bonded over our shared love for Big Sur, for the ecology and the human history of the place. And our friendship lasted many years and withstood many travails. Jeff even forgave me twice for turning down his romantic advances in favor of far lesser men. So in 2007, I took a job here in Idaho, and after I moved to Boise, Jeff and I corresponded frequently by phone. And Jeff really scared me one day when he called me to tell me he was in the hospital. So when Jeff was a very young man, he had Hodgkin's lymphoma. And in those days, the treatment for Hodgkin's was really extreme. They irradiated the whole chest wall. And by doing that, they permanently damaged his heart valves. But because Jeff had never had enough income to afford health insurance, he couldn't get his valves fixed. And one day, he awoke at Alta Vista, and he was so weak he couldn't stand. And he crawled across the floor of the cabin and out across a meadow to where he knew on a really good day he could sometimes get a very weak cell phone signal that would knife edge over the mountains to the cell tower located in the distant north. And that was a lucky day. He got a signal and he called 911 for a medical helicopter. Well, the helicopter came and picked him up and took him to the hospital in Salinas. And when he got there, the doctors told him that they needed to do emergency heart surgery, and that while they were in there, they were going to replace his valves with pig valves, which is a common heart replacement surgery technique. So when Jeff awoke from anesthesia, the doctors asked some questions to determine his mental status. And they said, you know, Jeff, do you know where you are? And Jeff croaked, hospital. And then they said, Jeff, do you know why you're here? And Jeff said, oink. So after Jeff left the hospital, he was very lucky to have a dear friend named Kathy who lived at sea level and graciously allowed him to convalesce at her house. And he was there for a few weeks, but he kept having problems with bleeding around his lungs. And one day when no one else was home, he collapsed. By the time the medics arrived and took him to the hospital, he had been unconscious for an unknown length of time. And later that day, Kathy called me from the hospital to tell me that Jeff had died. Well, I was devastated, of course. And Kathy asked if a week later I could call back to help plan a memorial service for Jeff, which I did. And on the phone on that call were four other individuals and couples who had been very close to Jeff. And Kathy surprised all of us by, instead of memorial planning, she produced a copy of Jeff's will. And in his will, Jeff had left Alta Vista to the five of us. So Oscar Wilde once said that in this world there are only two tragedies. One is not getting what one wants, and the other is getting it. Well, after all these years of wanting more than anything else my own place in Big Sur, I had gotten what I wanted, and it was a tragedy. And unfortunately for us, the tragedies didn't end there. Because Jeff hadn't had health insurance, he died leaving nearly $1 million in medical bills. And we feared that Alta Vista would be auctioned to pay those bills. So we set about talking to all the creditors and trying to get them to forgive or reduce that debt so that we could save the property. And we were successful with most of them, but we're still left with hundreds of thousands of dollars owed. We came to terms with the fact that we were going to have to sell Alta Vista. The only ray of hope in all this is there is a conservation group called Save the Redwoods League in Big Sur that we knew would protect the cabin and the cultural resources of the property and would eventually transfer it into the state park that it's an inholding in. It would be permanently protected. So we started negotiating with the league to sell them Alta Vista. So at this point, I thought things could not get any worse, and then something happened that proved me wrong. One day in June, a lightning storm hit the coast. The Basin Complex Fire, as it was eventually called, burned more than 160,000 acres of Big Sur. But based on fuel loading, it burned spotty and patchy, and we hoped that since Alta Vista sat on a meadow, it would be spared. So after the main fire front had passed, a couple of the heirs sweet-talked their way past the highway patrol roadblocks and hiked up to Alta Vista. And the scene they encountered as they ascended the trail was, if any of you have read The Road, you know, that was the scene. You know, ankle-deep ash, the smell of sulfur, redwood trees that were massive in the canopy were just scraps where they met the ground. And as they crested the rise to Alta Vista, they were heartbroken. Every structure had burned. The cabin was a skeleton of water lines in a cabin shape. Pages from Jeff's library fluttered through the black trees. The solar panel batteries were a melted pile of smoking, toxic slag. The crockery glaze had melted all the plates and bowls together, and the jars of insect specimens had been reduced to crystalline goo. Later, Save the Redwoods League kept to their commitment to buy Alta Vista from us, and with that, the property passed into the hands of state parks to be protected forever. A year after Jeff died, we hiked to Alta Vista. We scattered Jeff's ashes on the ashes that had been his cabin's threshold, and I knew that I would never again have a chance at having my own place in Big Sur. The hills were merciless black, and the ocean was gray. But in that ocean, I knew there were sharks and otters and whales and jade. And I realized that my love for Big Sur was unabated. I still, even tonight telling you about it, I feel faint with it. And I think that's maybe what love is. I accept Big Sur just the way it is. And no matter what tragedies Big Sur puts me through, I will always take it back. Thank you.
Love is in the air, and so are a few new initiatives starting in March from Story Story Night. First, we're introducing a new priority seating ticketing system. Here's how it works. 2 weeks before each show, we'll sell a limited number of tickets online. On event nights, doors open to these advanced ticket holders from 6 to 6:30 p.m. People with priority seating tickets can get in after that time, of course, but finding a seat then might be a star-crossed endeavor. At 6:30 p.m., like usual, doors and sales open to the public at large for first-come, first-served tickets. The cost remains only $5 for either option, though processing fees do apply for advance tickets. Priority seating tickets for March 28th's Rebellion, Stories of You Say You Want a Revolution, go on sale today, March 14th. Secure your spot now by visiting storystorynight.org and clicking on the brown paper ticket image to the right, or by going directly to brownpapertickets.com. The second thing I want to mention is something I think you're really going to love. Introducing the Story Story Studio, a new workshop series from Story Story Night. Held the third Monday of every month, the studio is geared to bring out your voice with real life stories. Our first session, Ideas, will be held on March 21st at Colmar Coffee House at 7 p.m. We hope to see you there. Now, back to the regularly scheduled program. Next up, Martha DeSimon sets out on a backpacking trip written in the stars.
It's my first time here, and you don't see it, but on my forehead, it did say, "I do not date." That is what I heard from my bestest friends and my family. And that went on for 7 years. And I was loving life after my divorce. And I come to Idaho. I drove 2,500 miles. I took an awesome spontaneous road trip. And I said, purge yourself of negativity. Go do something different. So I Googled Idaho Outdoors, and I got involved with a group of people, and some of you are here tonight, and they're going to witness this. They witnessed our the love story. So anyway, I thought, oh, I need to go backpack. I don't know what backpacking is. I know you put things on your back, and you haul it, and you go somewhere. I had no gear whatsoever, and so everyone started pitching in, and I had a backpack with tape on it, and I don't know what else. I had a sleeping bag that I had that was this big, and someone gave me one that was this big, and I just shut. We had a terrible storm. I remember this. I was at work, and I was like, I didn't even pack for this backpacking trip. Nothing, no food, anything. I gotta go do something. And I throw everything into the back of my car in the trunk and into the backpack, but it was all disassembled. And so we get to where we're going, and I'm still trying to get this, act like I know what I'm doing, this backpacking. And so we finally get there to where we're going. And we end up at Redfish Lake at 7 in the morning in a very thick fog. And there, the boat was there with one guy, very handsome guy there. I didn't know he was handsome at that time. And I didn't know that we were going to be lovers today. And everyone was saying, hey, I have to tell you, the key part of this was there were 8 women and 2 guys on this backpacking trip. 8 women. And all they kept saying for 5 hours as we're thrashing through the woods, that handsome guy, you've got to slow down, Martha. Talk to him. Just, he's divorced, and he doesn't have any kids, and he's so handsome. So I'm like, what? What? I never paid attention to him. I get on the boat, and I'm like, oh, my God, what am I doing? I'm going backpacking. I don't know what I'm doing. And Caroline handed me her trekking poles, and I had stuff just thrown on my backpack. And I was, as we're going through the woods and the off trail and everywhere, and my stuff is getting shredded, and I'm, like, wet up to here. And I'm like, keep going. And so anyway, we stop about, I don't know, it's like 3 hours into our hike, and we were filtering water or something, and what was this thing? This gadget's coming out, and it's water, and we're supposed to drink it. And so I look at this guy, this handsome guy that I've been hearing about, this, you know, and I turn around, and I look at him, and I go, all right, he's very nice looking. So he turned around, we're filtering water, and he turns around to me, and he goes, can we get married? And I thought, run, Martha, run. It's not right. No, run. Don't give up your independence. When you commit, you've lost your independence. So I thought, oh, God, this is weird. And everyone's they're hearing this. Vicky, they're like, and Vicky told me later, she goes, you were really rude to him. And I said, I probably don't remember what I said. And so I said, I think we need to get to know each other. He goes, yeah, you need some gear. He goes, look at your gear, your backpacking gear. And I thought, well, that's doable. That's good. So, and everyone was telling me, the gear, your gear. In fact, Leo, the next morning, he goes, Martha, do you need help with your packing your backpack for like the duration of our 3-day, 3-night trip? You know, we're going up Reward Peak and we're going here and there. I'm like, yeah, I guess, help me. So Leo comes over to my pack and he's like, I don't even know what he was thinking. But anyway, got it organized to where it looked nice. So as we're back to the field where we all kind of after 5 hours, and we had decided, I don't know if you guys know this, but when you go hiking, whenever you see someone, don't you always say, where are you going? Because you don't want to go to the same place. It's like, thank God you're not going to the same place. Well, we say this to this handsome guy on the boat, and he says, Catherine Lakes. And we say, Catherine Lake. And we go, well, we're going. And he's thinking, oh my God, 10 people at Catherine Lakes. He was like mortified. Well, he was actually very personable, and we were all going to go together. Well, we get to this big field, and he says, and he's going to go his way, and we're going to go our way. And he said, I'd really like to stay in touch with you. And I says, well, I have to tell you something. I'm really busy, and I don't date. And he said, you're perfect for me. And I said, okay, that's good. And so we're trying to find a pen or something to put our a number. I'm like, I'm getting your number. You're not going to get mine, definitely. And so, I'm not even done. I'm not done. And so anyway, I said, listen, I really stay in touch best by email. And he goes, I don't do email. I got, oh, and I thought, well, he's not into porn. Okay, I really did think that. I said, okay, I'm safe there. That's okay. And so anyway, I got his phone number. And as we're leaving, after our backpacking trip, he's gone. I'm gone. I got his number. And we're in Stanley, and we're recovering with pizza, the whole group, the 10 of us. And they're like ragging on me. Are you going to call him? Are you going to call him? Are you going to call him? I'm like, he's a big boy. Of course he got back okay. He's fine. Of course, you know. And I thought, so I'm recovering back in my house. And I'm like, oh, that was a great trip. I survived backpacking. And I didn't even think about it. I'm unpacking. I'm like, the number. And so I'm like, I call. And so anyway, I said, yeah. And I call him about the gear. And yeah, I want to come up and check your gear out. That sounds kind of weird, doesn't it? Your gear. I got to tell you. So we decided that Saturday. I guess you got to let me finish this story. It's so good. It's so good. And so we decided that Saturday. I said, I'm coming through anyway because I like to bike up to Prairie Creek. I mean, you guys know me. I'm not competitive. I bike up to Prairie Creek. And so he said, perfect. I love to cycle too. And he said, I go, I'm going to come check out your gear. So I happened to be with a bunch of friends, about 10 or 15 of us, and we were talking. They go, hey, you going to go check that guy out? And I go, yeah, I just called him. I'm going to go up Saturday. They go, are you going to go check his gear out? Remember he said all this gear? And I go, yeah. And so the big joke was Martha's going to check this gear out. And so the whole time I'm driving up there, I'm like, do not kiss. Do not kiss. Never kiss. No, don't kiss on first date. No, no. First time, don't kiss because you can't stop. Then it's first base, second base. Where do you stop? I mean, like, you put a time frame on this when you're going to go to the fourth base. So I'm like, don't kiss. That was the whole thing I told myself. Don't kiss. So as I'm doing that, so he said, he calls me. And I'm like, well, that's weird. I don't like people checking on me. And so he just wanted to make sure that, you know, we get into town and he'd tell me where he lives. And so anyway, we did our Prairie Creek bike ride and we were having a ball. Just, oh, what a great day. It was just very spontaneous. And it was about, and we did finally got to the gear, his backpacking gear, trust me. And it was like 10 at night and he was like worried. He wanted me to spend the night because he didn't want me driving. I'm like, listen, I just drove 2,500 miles. I have a really good time with me, myself, and I. And so, anyway, I said, Martha, leave. Don't spend the night. Leave, go. And so I left. So he walks me down to the, I'm done. And so he walks me down to my car and he says, I don't want to kiss you. He says, but I want to tell you that you gave me the best birthday I've ever had. He said, I turned 60 today. And so from that day forward, we stayed in touch because he doesn't have email, snail mail, and the good old fashioned telephone dating, and it was truly love at first sight. And from there forward, and Denise can vouch, we have a great time together. And anyway, it's great because he lives the I do not date. He lives in Ketchum. He's 100. That was always my rule, 150 miles away. I can't live. You're going to have to live next door to me as the very closest, but I cannot live together. And so it's perfect. He's in Ketchum, and I'm in Boise, and it's a honeymoon every time we see each other.
Thank you for listening. Story Story Night is brought to you by presenting partner the Boise State Story Initiative, venue partner the Linen Building, design partner Neighborhood All-Stars, and our broadcast partner Boise State Public Radio. Please donate now at radio.boisestate.edu. Our Story Story Night theme is by Dan Costello. Hear more at hearcostello.com. Please join us next week for the final act from Star-Crossed Love. Learn more at storystorynight.org.